Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, I'd like to welcome back Dr. Rebecca Sadoun, who is an associate professor of adult and pediatric rheumatology at Duke University School of Medicine, as well as Dr. Dima Cintron, who is a combined internal medicine and pediatric physician who's currently pursuing a combined adult and pediatric rheumatology fellowship, also at Duke University. And we are excited to welcome you back today to talk about strategies and steps patients can take towards the transition from pediatric to adult care. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Excited to be back.
All right. So we talked in our last conversation a little bit. We talked through a lot of the transition points, but let's get a little bit into the family side of things. So as families are transitioning with their child to adult care, what kind of steps should they take as the family to prepare for the transition to adult rheumatology care?
Yeah. So getting ready is truly building your checklist. And we think a priority for any family and patient is to have a place where the information about that patient's health is going to be. Now, that can be very different. It could be a phone document. It could be a formal document that's written down. We have parents and patients who have notebooks. So just having a place where all that information is going to be stored, information that includes diagnosis, list of medications, past medications, and any side effects is really helpful for that adult provider who's going to get to meet the patient. And then if a patient has multiple providers, having a list of all those different providers in the same place is a good way to start summarizing that information. A second step that we recommend is making sure you review your insurance early. Having that conversation with your insurance company, when will I need to change insurance? It's also an important part of really preparing slowly to make that transition.
Yeah. I think that's well said. I'd add two things. So one is we sometimes talk about this phrase adult model of care. And that's the concept where the provider asks a question and the young adult patient is the first person to answer it. And you don't have to wait until somebody turns 18 or till somebody starts seeing an adult rheumatologist to have that. In fact, we recommend kind of implementing some of that at a much earlier age, certainly by the age of 16. And the parent can chime in afterwards, but letting the teenager be the first one to answer the question first. And that just, you know, builds that skill so that they're ready for it independently down the road. And the same, we also recommend adult model care. Ideally, the pediatric provider would even ask the parent to step out of the room for just a couple of minutes so that teen gets some practice at speaking independently, asking questions, answering questions, giving history on their own.
Interesting. I always tell my kids this is why I make them go order their own food at
restaurants.
Yes. I literally told my 9-year-old that the other day, right? Because if you always do it for them, then you're always doing it for them. The next thing you know, they're 20 and you're still ordering their spaghetti. Yeah.
I've been with some kids now that are 19 that like they can't order Subway. And it's I feel like for them that's a loss, right?
Yes.
But that awkward moment when the kids look at you. Sorry, you had a second one, but you made me ordering food.
Anytime you practice a new skill, it feels like you're stretching yourself, but that's good because you're learning it. And the flip side of that is, parents should kind of push and nudge and help the child learn those skills and practice those things. But it's not exactly the same as pushing somebody out of a nest and hoping they fly or watching them fall. It's, giving a little bit more autonomy, a little bit more, but still being around as a safety net. So, what I sometimes see parents do is do everything for the teen or young adult up until a point, and then sort of hit a breaking point. And they're like, you're 18 or you're 22. It's time for you to do it. And so then, even though the teen has never been the one to answer any questions or ask any questions or do anything independently, all of a sudden the parent doesn't show up to the visit. They're like, you're on your own. You got this. and they don't necessarily got it at the very first time they're trying it. So, you know, do nudge and push and encourage, but kind of like be around as a backup for a little while until you see that they're flying on their own.
Yeah, it's a little bit like in our first episode, you talked about moving from the passenger seat to the driver's seat. And then usually someone sits in the passenger seat with you for a bit before you.
Yeah.
I love this analogy.
Add real quickly, some parents have different strategies. So for example, they're going to start the independent skills of the patients picking up the medications in the pharmacy. So usually different small things could be having the patient go pick up the medications, but the parent is going to be somewhere in the pharmacy, somewhere close. So if anything comes up, mom or dad are close by. The same for when a patient's going to call to schedule an appointment. Yeah, the patient will have the phone, we'll be talking, but mom is like sitting right next to them. So you slowly build up the skill sets without having to go from 0 to 100 and going into a little panic attack.
Yeah. Well, because that creates avoidance and missed appointments, right? Okay. So a little bit more on that, because my next question is like, what are the common mistakes that families can avoid when preparing for the transition?
Yeah. So one of them is kind of waiting too long, sort of preparing the week before somebody leaves for college. And then therefore having to try to transition that responsibility like overnight, or transition providers overnight. And that's just really tough. So the more you can do it gradually, the better things go. Giving time to establish rapport again is really important. We talked about that in the last episode, but when people sort of have a first visit and like give up and feel like, hey, there's not the right connection and I'm not going to go back, and then don't go see anybody, that's a big pitfall. So just giving it time to feel comfortable, I think, is important. And then the other one is, as the young adult hopefully like moves out and has their own life and is taking on more and more responsibility, just knowing who their resources are and reaching out and utilizing them. So there's no parent who wouldn't still be happy to get a call that says like, I feel like maybe my back is flaring. I don't know. Maybe it's my mattress. Maybe it's my disease. What should I do? Right. We talk about, you know, parents are kind of the CEO of their young child's healthcare. And then the goal is at one point for the young adult to take over and become the CEO of their own healthcare. But the parent doesn't disappear. Ideally, the parent retires to the like board of advisors. So yeah. They're still there to be advised. Yeah. Reach out when there's something big going on. And the same, reach out with your rheumatologist. Let them know. Communicate frequently. Share any blips. We'd rather hear about the little one that's maybe a flare, where we can, schedule some labs or do a quick exam and catch it early and, you know, just have to make some small tweaks in the medicine, than when we hear about it after it's really bad and then we have to make big changes, lots of steroids or steps back.
Yeah, that's never a fun pathway. So as people, young people, are moving toward this transition, how do you recommend they develop self-management skills in the transition?
So we always like to assess, and I think assessments are good. It's always when we're in our clinics, I'm like, I'm going to give you a questionnaire. It almost feels like a quiz, and it can be a little scary or annoying and during the visit, but it is a great tool. It gives us an idea of how the patient, how you are doing, what particular areas do we still need some work on. So we have, like I have mentioned before, the transition readiness assessment questionnaire is a 20 item questionnaire that can be quickly assessed during a clinic visit and can be a great point of discussion. The patient can fill it in a few minutes, and then from that questionnaire, kind of guide the discussion of where, what particular areas we can focus on and what particular skill sets parents can focus on with their kiddos so that that independence continues to grow. And then again, independent skills that are gradually built up, like going to pick up their medications, having them call for their appointments or rescheduling their appointments, and then gradually seeing their provider independently. So, I mean, sometimes just a few minutes, 2 minutes, providers can ask parents to step out, and then 2 minutes where that patient is guiding the discussion is a huge step.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what kind of questions do you ask on the track? Is it like, have you picked up your medication on your own? Sort of the checklist of like, you're ready to fly?
Exactly. And the answers are, I'm doing this completely independently, or I'm starting to do this, or I want to learn to do this, or my parent does this for me. And so our goal usually is to advance things one stage. So if it's like, yeah, my mom does everything for me, we say like, pick one thing on the sheet, one goal, and start practicing it. And, you know, do that one thing between now and the next clinic visit. And the next visit, I'll say, how's that going? Any help we can provide? And then let's pick one more thing that you can learn to do. And parents can do the exact same thing. You know, that list is, it's like a map, a roadmap. It's where you want to go, right? At some point, the young adult should be doing all of it. But it would be completely overwhelming to ask the young adult to assume responsibility for all of it at once. So what's a low-hanging fruit? Look at it. What things can you decide together are not as intimidating, or something that actually maybe the young adult would even look forward to getting to do independently, and pick one thing at a time, develop one skill at a time, and just keep chipping away at it.
Yeah, I wondered that. Like, and I would guess that for some kids, once they start to get some of their own autonomy on these things, they accelerate quickly. Like, oh, I can do this myself. Oh, I can do this. Oh, maybe we should develop that just for like
very. I also said that thing about two steps forward, one step back, and sometimes that applies to these skills too. They're like, oh, I totally can fill out my pail box, and it's new and it's exciting, and they do amazing for 3 weeks, and then it's no longer new and exciting, and then they kind of break off a little. And that's one of those reasons that you practice it while at home with a parent who can be like, I haven't seen the pillbox move in a week. Something's not right.
Yeah.
And that's normal. Like, don't freak out when it happens. That's part of the growing pains. And
that's part of adulthood too. Right. and then like any other strategies they can use for consistent follow-up care. We talked a little bit about, but any other wisdom there?
Yeah. I always recommend asking the rheumatologist, like, how often do you feel I should be seen if things are going well? And then making sure, you know, if the answer was every 3 months, that there's always an appointment on the books within a 3 month window. If it was every 6 months, that there's, you know, at least two visits happening a year, never more than a 6 month gap. Just scheduling those on a calendar, a phone alarm, whatever it takes. And like I had mentioned in the first episode, if you ever have to reschedule, and we get it, that's life, that happens sometimes, don't just cancel, but reschedule so that you always have an appointment on the books. There's never like that indefinite gap that can just grow into, oops, I fell out of care.
Right. And then what resources that we haven't talked about are available during the transition, and how do kids or families access those?
So it will depend on every patient. Every patient has what works for them. So it's a trial and error. I think giving them these a try. There are multiple apps, and we know that our teenagers, young adults can be very tech savvy. There's actually some really good apps out there. I'm just going to give two examples today, but there's an app called My Transition. It's free for both Mac, iPhones, and it's a great app. It helps keep a list of your healthcare team. Within that application, you can keep your calendar appointments. And what I liked about this one is that it forces the patient to give a brief 3-sentence health summary. So you have to synthesize your health history within 3 sentences, which is sometimes a nice briefer, especially if you have an emergent urgent care or ED visit. To have that 3-liner is really useful. And then it also has a transition readiness questionnaire there. So kind of an assessment tool to see kind of where you're at, some self-reflection to see how to help transition. So that is, I think, a good, useful app. And then I've had a lot of patients just use apps for their medication list. And MediSafe Medication Management is an application on the phone that is very simple. It helps set reminders to improve the medication compliance. And you're going to like this. You can add a caregiver to your application so they send you a reminder to take your pills.
Oh, I like that.
It's a very, yes. And I mean, it's definitely dependent on the patient. If they want mom and dad to still be involved, they can add the caregiver. If they don't, then they take full independence. But I think it adds that additional peer buddy system, and then also helps you keep track of certain symptoms, nausea to your symptom, to your medications, insomnia. So really good. And you can also get a weekly adherence summary at the end. So you see how you're doing this week. I didn't do too well, or I did great. So two good application resources that patients can give a try and see if it helps them or not.
I love that. I need the second one just for my day-to-day
life. That's the one that I've heard the most, and that is Safe. Patients really like this one.
Yeah, I need that one just to remind me to do like the laundry. So those were great. Thank you. So let's turn a little bit toward communication and how does effective communication between the peds and adult provider make the transition smoother?
It definitely is helpful for the patient when both the pediatric and adult providers can directly have a conversation. And ideally we would want this to happen in every scenario where a patient's being transrenal, that's different dynamics and just differences in how practices are done in different areas of the world. But Dr. Sedunier, Rebecca, and Dr. Laura Schoenberg back in 2018 helped develop a really nice and easy mnemonic that can be used by pediatric subspecialists when they're doing that transfer discussion to kind of keep that conversation very tailored and short. So most of the important information is transferred. So transfer, the mnemonic T stands for treatment history. R stands for recent complications, recent med changes. A for adherence challenges, and if there's any particular causes that the pediatric subspecialist has identified, sharing that with the adult provider. N for needs or other referrals particular to that patient. S for social history, any social challenges, any particular important things about this patient's social life that we should be aware of in the adult setting. F for financial insurance challenges. E for any emotional or intellectual challenges, and R for reason this is a good time for transfer. Either the patient is stable, we did a transition to college and the patient is at a good place to see an adult provider. So that mnemonic transfer really can facilitate and make this a short, succinct process that helps the adult provider and ultimately helps the patient.
And when I think of communication, like my personal favorite is the phone, right? Direct having a chat about a patient is wonderful, a great way to pass the baton, but there are lots of other very effective ways to pass the information along. So maybe the pediatric rheumatologist will like fax or e-fax a note over, or maybe they'll send a message through the electronic health records. Or the other thing is if there isn't a good convenient way for them to directly send information from one side to the other, what you can ask for is help with an electronic medical summary and or a letter. And so they can even print that out and hand that to you, and you can bring that to the new adult provider who maybe is in a different system or a different state or a different country. And that helps that the important information get relayed from the former provider to the new provider.
And is it standard practice to do something like that, to do a transfer?
No, it's been studied and it happens the minority of the time. And that's been studied in multiple countries. And whenever we look at what would make things better, you know, every group of experts says the more communication there can be, the better it goes, especially the ability to say, hey, we tried X and it didn't work. We tried Y and it didn't work. And we tried Z and it worked halfway. And so we had to double the dose. And now we're in a good place. And when that can be communicated, then the new provider doesn't need to, but go through the bumps of trying X and Y all over again.
Yeah.
So it's nice and it is smooth. What I know a lot of really responsible, wonderful patients and families try to do is get the whole medical record. And I'm like, bless your heart. They went to the Department of Medical Records and they ordered and probably paid for it, like 20 cents a page, what turns into a 1,000 page tome of mostly irrelevant junk. It is really unfortunate because then the new provider gets, I am not kidding you, 1,000 pages. It is sometimes like more than a foot tall. And it's actually really hard to like extract the important information. And I would any day rather the last two medical notes and a like two paragraph summary from the previous provider, which is cheap and it's fast and it's easy and it gives me more information in less time.
So I want to know, when you designed the mnemonic, did you start there, or was it like, how do I fit this into transfer?
Yeah, I definitely played around with a few things, but wanted it to fit a word that made sense that people could remember.
I love it. I love it though. I think it's fantastic. I mean, it really follows, like, I mean, if you're changing a shift at a hospital, you would do that.
Yeah. Yep. And this came out of, actually, I gave a talk about a curriculum I developed for adult fellows in terms of like the skills that they can use to make this process easier for patients. And I gave that curriculum to a bunch of fellows and I asked them what they felt better about at the end of it. Where did they have more confidence? What was easy? And the one thing that hadn't improved was their confidence in talking to a pediatric rheumatologist. And so I was presenting on this and somebody said, well, like, did you teach them how to do it? And I was like, no, I guess I thought like, you know, chatting, like people know how to chat, right? Like, and then that question that she asked just kind of rang in my head again and again. I was like, you know what? Let's create a mnemonic. What are the things that they should discuss? And I feel like that's made the process a little easier.
No, that's amazing. Okay. So, and in my head, I was thinking you could like have a, you could do like webinars or like evening with your new adult rheumatologist. So do you have any personal advice or stories of patients who have made the transition successfully, and are a little further out in the range?
Yeah, I think I learn a lot from my teenagers and young adults. And like I said, I respect them so much. This is not easy. Being a teenager is not easy. Being a young adult is not easy. So having to successfully do this transition is such a great milestone. But I do remember a lovely teenager who became a young adult and we transitioned to the adult setting. And I kind of, we were able to do it. She gained all her independent skills gradually. And I remember asking her when we were on the adult setting, like, from all the things that we chatted about, what was the thing that worked? Where did it all click? And she honestly just told me, like, you know, I don't really remember a lot of the nitty gritty things and the diagnostics. And what I remember is you telling me that you were going to be part of my team and that I wasn't going to be alone throughout the process. And I think as a young adult, that makes sense. I think there's a lot of expectations as a young adult, how quickly you regain your independence and kind of build on things by yourself. And being part of a team, I think, plays such a big role for her. That is a learning point for me to always remind my young adults and teenagers that we're part of a team and we're going to get through it together.
I actually had a patient who reached out to me today who just reminds me of what that process can be like. And I feel like is sort of the inspiring. She's gotten there. She's crossing the finish line. She was diagnosed actually pretty young with spondylitis. She was 12. And obviously her parents were bringing her in. They were coming from a long distance. They were hours away, but they brought her, you know, consistently and religiously, and she was getting consistent care and they were overseeing her medications and things were relatively smooth on the pediatric side. And then she went away to college, and actually college was closer to where I am. So she lived 20 minutes away and her parents were still hours away. And so very understandably, they were like, okay, you're a, you know, responsible young adult, and transitioned all the responsibility to her. And it was bumpy. Like I said, like life happens, and she was working and going to school and a lot going on, living on her own for the first time. You know, for some of it, I think she had a car. For some of it, there was a bus. For some of it, you know, just it's complicated.
Yeah.
So when she was feeling well, she would kind of miss follow-up appointments and not come back. And then at some point, things would flare up, and she wouldn't come back when it was a little flare. She'd wait until it was terrible. It was so bad. It was controlling her life. She could barely sleep at night. She was sitting up in a chair because her hip pain was so bad. It was rough. And there were starts and stops to this process along through that. You know, we'd get her back on meds, she'd get a little bit better, and the kind of cycle would repeat. But I have just noticed huge strides forward in terms of her maturity lately. And today she sent me this message and she said, you know, we had a conversation at the last visit about medicine A versus medicine B. I tried out that new technique you said. I now like the shots better. I'm icing the area before I'm giving myself a shot. Now it doesn't hurt. Now I feel comfortable sticking with that plan. Can you therefore refill my medicines for me? Because I will run out in a couple of weeks. Not I ran out a couple of weeks ago, but in a couple of weeks, like reaching out early, it was just like, oh my God, we have arrived. It is amazing. There was lots of two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes it felt like four steps back.
Yeah.
But we got there. We got there. I'm so proud of her. And it works out. And just remember to have the faith. Keep plugging away. Keep that relationship going. And we all get there in the end.
Yeah. Can I ask you both a question? Why did you go this route?
Yeah, that is great. That is a great question. You know, I always like to say med peds, double the trouble, double the fun, because it is sometimes double the trouble. You know, that this is a unique niche of patients, but they're so lovely. And I think there's so much need and you learn so much from them. I like this population a lot. I like teenagers. I like young adults. I think they're spunky. I think our encounters are always fun. There's always transitions and life changes happening, and you take them by the hand and you're kind of going through it with them. And I think that's the most exciting thing of being a med peds. You never let them go. You go through all those life stages with them.
You see patients from how young to how old?
All ages.
All
absolutely
ages.
Anyone.
All that's kinds. Amazing. I love that. We need more of that. Okay, Dr. Sadoun, we now want to hear from you.
Yeah, I think that was put really well. There's no question adolescents and young adults can be the most challenging age group to work with. And I think maybe that's why I love it. One of my favorite things about being a doctor is not just writing the prescription that helps control the inflammation, although of course I like that as well. It is helping people learn to adjust to their disease, learn to grow stronger because of it, learn to incorporate into their life and learn to thrive despite it. Just how you internalize it, how you identify your sense of self-identity despite having this, who are you beyond your spondylitis, all of those things. And so being able to be part of that process with a young adult is so powerful. Making sure that they're not I can't because I have spondylitis. I couldn't go to college, or I would never be able to hold down a job. Helping them say of course I can. It's just a matter of how can I? Maybe right. I need to stand up and walk around in the classroom so that my back doesn't get too stiff, but of course I can go and do everything that I want to do and be who I want to be.
Oh, I love that. Okay. Any final advice for people preparing for this transition?
We talked a little bit about some of those skills that are important. And I don't know if we talked about the one of kind of formulating your questions before you get to a medical visit. But I would really encourage that. Write down your questions in advance so you don't forget the things that were important to you. And share the internal dialogue. So we'll have patients come and they'll say they're having symptoms, and I'll say, well, how about we do this? Whether that this is an injection or a new pill or a new strategy. And they'll be like, okay, because they feel like that's the right answer to give. But really what's going on in the back of their head is, I'm not so sure about this. I don't like shots. I don't want to go that route. I'll never remember a pill, whatever their concern is. If you can share that concern with your provider, then you get to work together on figuring out what will work in your life. If you just nod your head and say, okay, to something that you know is not going to be a great strategy for you, then you probably won't take the shot that you don't feel comfortable giving yourself. And then nobody wins, right? So we're all on the same team. Share your concerns, ask your questions, really be an active partner with your provider so that we can work together to get you better.
Yeah, I love that. It's like going to the makeup counter and not buying the $62.50 thing. You know, you're never going to wash your face at night.
Yeah.
That's from honesty. Yeah. Honesty is probably one of the most important things. I think those would be my two pieces of advice. Honest with your providers, and then starting early.
Yeah.
The earlier, the more time you give us and the more time you give yourself, the better outcomes we'll have.
I love it. Any other, and advocating, I think coming up with the question, is really important, right? It's a skill. Okay. So I think that's about it. Did I miss anything? This has been amazing.
You asked great questions and
really good. We had all the highlights. Yeah.
I think it's so powerful that you've been through this. You've been experiencing these symptoms yourself, and you were an adult when you were diagnosed, but I think you can relate to a lot of it's hard to be a patient and have a chronic disease, and it's even harder to do that while you're going through adolescence or young adulthood.
Yeah, and I will say, even when I was going through the years before diagnosis, I hit a point where I was like, I'm done going to doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even, at that point I hadn't gotten to a rheumatologist, but I was like, I was completely non-compliant. I was like, I'm not going to doctors, I'm not taking the pills you give me, I'm not doing this. And thankfully, I got to a rheumatologist.
I'm glad you were happy to have. The other thing is, it can really be hard to be a parent and let go at all, right? We all want best for our child. And if our child doesn't seem to be stepping up to the plate, then we're like, let me do it for them. It's their health that matters. And I meet a lot of parents who say, like, I know that the literature says when they're 12, they can start, or when they're 16, but my child's different. My child can't do it. I need to do it for them. And I try to remind them of a couple of things. One is, like, you don't want, as a parent, to be 85 years old and to have your, you know, 60-year-old child picking you up from the nursing home on the way to their doctor's appointment, right? Like, let's think into the future. There absolutely will come an age and a stage when you want your young adult to be doing this on their own, right? And so if you know that's the goal, that's where you're headed, you got to take steps along the way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it would be interesting to hear from hear the parent.
Yeah, it happens a lot because, like, we're all scared, right? And when you come from that place of fear, you know, especially from health, it's a serious thing, and you don't want to let go too soon. You don't want bad things to happen. And I appreciate that. Like I said, you know, you're in the passenger seat. You don't let go, but you do have to let them drive at some point, a little bit around the parking lot at first, like simpler, easier things. I also sometimes think about something my husband once said to me, which was really powerful for me. I forget how old my daughter was. She was probably a toddler. And he said, you know, she will always be able to do more than we give her credit for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that is true. And we have to, like, recognize that and give our children an opportunity to rise to the occasion, to prove to us what they can do.
That was a mic drop moment.
I know. I just, it's quiet. I just didn't say anything.
Well, thank you so much for joining. We'd love to have maybe a parent back sometime. That would be awesome.
Oh, I think that'd be great. Yeah.
Maybe we could do a parent and their child if they were.
Oh, that'd be powerful. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be? And hopefully it goes well and it doesn't turn into like a
choose wisely.
Awesome. Well, thank you, ladies, so much. And I'm so grateful for your time. And hopefully, I'm sure this will make the transition easier for some of our listeners.
I hope so. Yeah.
Thank you for what you do.
So nice to meet you, Jill. Bye. Yeah.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.